Wow. Mark chapter 9. That's all I can say. Well, actually, I have to say a whole lot more. I've got 11 minutes to fill. I'm Lance Leffler, and welcome to God Meets the Grind. I mentioned last episode that things are about to change rapidly and radically in the story of Jesus, and it all begins here. So let's jump in. Be sure to keep your hands and your feet in the car at all times. The chapter begins with Jesus taking Peter, James, and John up a high mountain where he's transfigured in front of them. He begins to radiate this brilliant light. Then Moses and Elijah appear somewhere there in the ether. Moses was one of Israel's greatest leaders, who God gave the law to. Elijah was one of Israel's greatest prophets. Both of them, by the way, lived more than 700 years prior. Peter, in abject terror, blurts out the strangest thing. Let's make three tents, one for Moses, Elijah, and you, Jesus. Why is this so crazy? Because I guarantee you, Peter didn't know the first thing about tent fabrication. But he wants to enshrine Jesus along with Israel's Hall of Famers. Just then, a cloud rolls in, and God's voice comes booming. This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. Suddenly, they look around, and there's only Jesus and them. Once again, we're faced with one unalterable fact. It's all about Jesus. When they're on their way back down the mountain, Jesus tells the disciples not to tell anyone what they just saw. How do you keep that a secret? I can picture it. What'd you do this weekend, Peter? Hey, didn't you go hiking on that mountain with Jesus? How'd that go? See anything cool? A quick aside here. You might have noticed that Jesus has said this like a half dozen times now. No, not, did you see anything cool? What I'm saying is he's warned people not to talk about whatever miracle they witnessed. And you've probably wondered why. I have two answers. The short one is, I also wonder why. The long one is, this is what's called the messianic secret. And Jesus might be doing it to keep his notoriety a little bit on the DL. Why? Because Israel was known around the empire for its radical insurrectionists that would rise up, make some crazy claims, rally the rabble and ne'er-do-wells to overthrow Rome and get their butts kicked and raise the ire of Rome against the Jews. It's just a possibility. When they make it to the bottom of the mountain, they see the rest of the disciples arguing with the scribes. Remember, they were the experts in the Old Testament scriptures. Over this demon-possessed boy they couldn't heal. It just cracks me up. The thought that Jesus' ragtag group of untrained fishermen were going toe-to-toe with the Bible experts. The conceit, the impudence, and the contempt the scribes must have had for them. But the scribes had to put up with it because, remember, Jesus' disciples worked a job. They were blue-collar, or is it blue-robe, and probably pretty tough. The scribes were no doubt the soft, cerebral types, so the disciples could have kicked their butts. Some people, myself included, have wondered whether it was a demon or epilepsy. Did the ancients attribute a neurological disorder to the demonic? One difference between epilepsy and this particular case is that the demon often cast him into the fire and into the water. So the boy's father runs to Jesus and begs him to heal his son, if he can. Jesus assures him that if he believes, he can. And I love the father's response. I believe. Help my unbelief. The older I get, the more this becomes like a theme verse for me. And so Jesus heals his son. From there, they pass through Galilee, and Jesus is teaching his disciples that he has to suffer and die. But after 3 days, he'll rise from the dead, so don't worry. But none of them understood a word of it. In fact, they probably didn't even hear it because they were too busy arguing. So they come to Capernaum, and Jesus turns to the disciples and asks, "Hey, what were you all arguing about on the road?" But man, they went quieter than a mob informant because they had been arguing about which one of them was the greatest. And now that Jesus brings it into the light, it feels a little bit more embarrassing. Somebody must have started spouting off about the amazing things he saw back there on that mountain. So Jesus takes a child and sets him in the midst of them. and says that whoever wants to be great needs to be servant of all. What's the point of the child, you ask? Okay, so you know how in our day children are really important with helicopter parents and playdates and all that? Kids wear $300 Nikes, influence retailers, and make their own medical decisions. But in Jesus' day, what I would call the good old days, children had very little status. They worked, they had no vote, and they controlled nothing. Jesus says that whoever receives or cares for one such child in his name receives him. He spins off using the word child and instead uses it to refer to believers in general, I think. But now, Mark jumps to a completely different story. We've seen that before. And absurdity continues to mount. The disciples have the unmitigated gall to bring up some incident that happened a while back. So the story goes, they saw some guy casting out demons. We'll call him the demon slayer. And they rebuked him because he didn't hang out with them. Some guy is out there doing what you're failing to do, and you rebuke him? Okay, back to the previous story. In verse 47, Jesus says, anyone who would cause one of these little ones to sin, that is, anyone who would shipwreck another's faith, it would be better for them to have a millstone hung around their necks and be cast into the sea. I think Jesus is expanding the definition of little ones here to mean believers in general. There's this whole cottage industry of skeptics on YouTube trying to do this very thing. They'd better hope Jesus is wrong. He closes out this chapter talking about cutting off hands and feet and plucking out eyes to fight temptation. Huh? This is where it's good to remember that while we basically take the Bible literally, it's pretty obvious that Jesus is speaking in hyperbole to make the point that we need to take extreme measures to fight sin sometimes. We already know that it's our heart that causes us to sin, not our extremities. Jesus already made this point back in chapter 7, verse 24. Jesus does turn a corner here, though. In the closing paragraph, he says it's better to take these drastic measures to fight sin in your life than to perish in hell. Okay, that's a bit of a showstopper, isn't it? Hell? In the 21st century? In the information age? In the age of sleep number beds and student loan forgiveness? I know. Nonetheless, Jesus delineates two destinations. One he alternately calls life, or the kingdom of God, and the other he calls hell and the unquenchable fire. So there is a life offered to us after this life, a life so much better than this life that it's called life in contrast to this life. And there is a hell which is pictured with the imagery of fire. A literal fire? That's debated. But even if it's not literal fire, the point of the imagery still comes across poignantly. So Jesus is saying that we should be motivated to cut sin out of our lives. Of course, we can never do that perfectly in this life, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We're not perfect at anything, but we still work at it. That's not the controversial part. Anybody with any inkling about religion knows it involves some sort of pursuit of virtue. The troubling part is where Jesus says there is a hell to be avoided. If that rubs you wrong, I can't untrouble you here. The notion of eternal consequences for our sin has all but disappeared in popular culture, or it's become fodder for satire. People will joke with each other that they're going to hell for this or that bit of irreverence, but they're joking. But Jesus isn't. It's interesting that 58% of Americans believe there is a hell. But the question comes up, how could a good God send people to hell? Just a quick response to this. It amazes me when I see all the wickedness in the world, the broken families, the molestation and abuse, the wars and torture, corrupt politicians and police, tyranny and slavery, cheating and utter contempt for our fellow humans, and that creeping evil that we have to beat back in our own hearts, that any enlightened person would ask this question. It's the only way there can be a just universe, if God holds us accountable after death. Jesus' last words in chapter 9 have confounded interpreters forever. Well, actually, just verse 49, where he says that everyone will be salted with fire. Probably the best understanding of this imagery is that the church will be purified by persecution. Jesus says this sort of thing in other places. Verse 50 is easier. as long as we understand, he's using salt in a different way here, where he says we need to be salty. A salty person today is someone who's, you know, riled up, hostile, and bitter. That's definitely not what Jesus meant. Although, judging by the attitudes of some Christians, you might think that's how they take it. In ancient times, before the advent of refrigeration, salt was a purifier and a preservative, as well as a spice. There was a Roman saying that there's nothing more useful than sun and salt. Given the way Americans love their salt, I would say things haven't changed much. I noticed it in restaurants especially. When they're serving subpar food, and they know it, they salt it to death. It covers a multitude of culinary sins, I suppose. But salt was essential in the first century. Roman soldiers were actually partially paid in salt, or sal, which was the Latin word for salt, which is where we get the word salary from. So then, what did it mean to be salty? It must be a reference to being Christ-like, since that's the goal of Christian living. Jesus finishes with this strange exhortation to have salt among yourselves and be at peace with one another. There's a fancy term for this. It's called synonymous parallelism. Don't glaze over on me. It just means that salt and peace mean the same thing in this sentence. They're parallel. There, that wasn't so bad, was it? And they needed that word from Jesus. The disciples had just argued among themselves about who was the greatest. They had just rebuked the demon slayer, remember him, for not following them. And we started the whole chapter off with them in a fight with the scribes. And with that, my friends, our wild ride through chapter 9 comes to an end. Please make sure you haven't left any personal items in the car, an exit to your left. Thanks for listening. If you like today's episode, please share it with somebody. Also, if you're on Facebook, would you go on and follow our God Meets the Grind Facebook page? Thank you so much. For more encouragement, go to godmeetsthegrind.com.